What do you do when times get tough? When you don't know what to do, when something is happening that you don't have any control over? What do you do when the future is coming and you don't know what you're going to do, where you're going to live, where you're going to work? People say it's good not to worry about things. Jesus says, do not worry. But how do we do that? Is it actually possible to live without worrying? What would a worry-free life look like? Can you imagine it? Is a worry-free life possible in our world of sin and suffering in the 21st century? Well, let's look at Psalm 4. Let's look at how David prays in a situation where he could be very worried. I've divided this psalm into five parts. So the first part is verse 1, which I've called the cry. You see, David is in distress. Look at verse 1. Give me relief from my distress. And he cries out to God. Now, people think Psalm 3 and Psalm 4 are kind of linked. They've been put together deliberately. So it could well be that this psalm is also written in the same context, which was the context of Absalom's rebellion against David. So just to remind you, we read in 2 Samuel of a time when Absalom, who's David's son, we read he stole the hearts of the men of Israel, and he ended up leading a sort of armed coup. David had to flee from Jerusalem, and essentially his own son was trying to kill him. So it was pretty bad. It was pretty bad. David is in distress, and he cries out to God. And we learn a lot about David's God just from this first verse, from the way that he cries out. So firstly, look at the start and the end of the verse. He says, answer me at the start, and at the end he says, hear my prayer. David's God hears prayer. David's God answers prayer. He's not an ignorant God. He's not a deaf God. He's not a God who isn't listening. Why does David cry out to God? Because he knows that God hears and God answers. And God is also, you have there, answer me when I call to you, my righteous God. You might have in your translation, God of my righteousness. Whatever you've got there, the idea should be that God is the upholder of justice, the upholder of righteousness. That's an appeal to God's justice. David's God is the upholder of justice. And God, look, gives relief. Look at what David says, give me relief. He knows that God is able and God is willing to help men who are in distress. That's good news, isn't it? That's good news in our world. And finally, David says, have mercy on me and hear my prayer. Have mercy on me. That's interesting. You might have grace there in your translation. Show me grace. That's an appeal for something undeserved, an appeal for undeserved favor. David recognizes that he doesn't actually deserve an answer from God. We're not given the background here, but if it is the Absalom situation, that's happened. We know from 2 Samuel that's happened because of David's sin. That's a consequence of David's sin. Maybe he's feeling that. Maybe he's very aware of that. But he knows that his God is a God of mercy, a God of grace. And from all of this, in verse 1, you can see that David's plea is based on God's character, on God's attributes, not himself, not his own attributes. Most human pleas that we hear are based on things like favors that are owed or rewards that are promised. You might hear things like this, this is what I deserve to have. You might hear it's my right to be treated in this way. It's my right to receive this. We cannot plead with God in that way. The only way to plead with God is to fall on his promised mercy. And that is what David does. What do we do when we're in distress? What do you do when you're in distress? Do you cry to God? That's the right thing to do. That's what David does. And we'll see some other people mentioned in this psalm who aren't doing that. And our pleas, just like David's plea, our cries must be based on God's character. How often do we pray like that, I wonder? How often do we speak of God's character? I wonder if we remembered these things about God, if we remembered that God answers prayer and hears prayer and God gives relief to his people, how would that affect our prayers? The enemy would love us to believe that God only occasionally hears prayer, really, and actually he rarely answers prayer. The enemy would love to have you believe that. It's not true. We have a God who hears and answers his people when they pray. We may not receive the answer we want. We might not receive the answer immediately. But God does hear and does answer prayer. And we need to remember that. So firstly, the cry of David. Secondly, look at verses 2 and 3. David isn't talking to God anymore. The psalm changes focus slightly. How long will you people, he says. He's talking to some people. I've called them the slanderers. You'll see why. Verses 2 to 3. We see something here, I think, of the reason why David is distressed. See, there are these people who turn his glory into shame. David is God's anointed king of God's people. And his God-given kingship is being turned into shame by these people. And I don't think David is just concerned about his own glory here, about his own throne and his own status as king. Look at the second half of the verse. How long will you love delusions and seek false gods? You might have lies instead of false gods there. It's really the same thing, isn't it? The lie that money will make you happy is the same thing as worshipping the God of money, isn't it? You see, David is really concerned that these people are loving delusions and seeking lies or seeking false gods. And notice they love delusions. These are not the deceived. They love delusions. They love to ignore the truth. They're actively seeking false gods, actively seeking lies. They find delusions lovely. What does that mean? What are the lovely delusions they might be seeking? Maybe Absalom is thinking, I'm feeling wronged, therefore I can do whatever I want. Maybe these people are thinking, God will not judge me. Maybe they're thinking, I can ignore God. I can ignore God's anointed king. I can set myself up as king. I can do whatever I want. Are those the thoughts of Absalom, or are they something closer to home? What are the delusions that people find lovely today, I wonder? God will not judge, or maybe people think, God will not judge me. Maybe that's a lovely delusion. God didn't create this world, it just came about by random chance. God does not define what is right or wrong. It doesn't matter what I do. God does not even actually exist. Riches will make me happy. We could go on, couldn't we? Why are those delusions lovely? Well, ultimately, I can do what I like without feeling guilty if I love those delusions. I can worship the gods of money, the gods of sex, the gods of power, the gods of any kind of fulfillment outside of the living God. I can ignore God. I can ignore God's anointed king and set myself up as king and do things how I want. And maybe you're thinking, well, of course, lots of people think that way, but I don't love these lies and these delusions. Well, what about in the moment of temptation, in the moment of sin? In that moment, are we not choosing to love a delusion? Are we not choosing to even seek the lie or seek the false god? We want to believe in that moment the lie that sin will make us happy that sin isn't really that serious. That doesn't really have any consequences. And look at what David says. He says, how long, doesn't he, to these people? And he says it twice. What does that mean? Notice he doesn't say, you're going to be judged because you love delusions. I think this is a call to stop loving delusions. So, as probably most of you know, Johnny and I drive to work together, and sometimes Johnny arrives at my house and I'm not 100% ready to leave the house. And Johnny might send me a message saying, he's actually a lot more polite than this, but he might send me a message saying, how long are you going to be? He actually would normally say something like, I'm outside, which has a subtext. But if he were to say, how long are you going to be? He doesn't want me to say, well, I think I'm going to be 2.25 hours. He's not after that answer. There's an implication, isn't there, when someone says, how long are you going to be? It's a call to say, I'm ready now, isn't it? And that's just what David is saying here. He's saying, how long will you turn my glory into shame? How long will you love delusions and seek false gods? It's a call to say, actually, now it's time to stop loving delusions. It's time to stop turning the glory of God's anointed king into shame. We mustn't love delusions. We mustn't seek false gods. We must flee from those things. So David is surrounded by these people who are loving delusions. And what's his answer? What's his response to these people? Read verse 3 with me. Know that the Lord has set apart his faithful servant for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. So they may be despising God. They may be despising God's anointed king. But God has set David apart. God hears David. I think there's a contrast there. The false gods aren't going to hear. They're not going to listen to you, but know the truth. And King David, as we know, had a greater, great, 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 great grandson, as we thought this morning. One who was man and yet God. One who promised that the meek would inherit the earth. One who was mocked, who was crucified, who had his glory turned into shame by the men around him. But the Lord had set him apart, and the Lord heard him, and God vindicated him. And actually verse 2 and 3 could describe Jesus today, couldn't it? There are plenty of people who mock his glory and who mock his followers today. But actually, the truth is, know this, God heard David, God heard Jesus, God will hear us if we're co-heirs with Christ, as Romans 8 tells us. When Jesus was slandered, God still heard him. When we are slandered for being his followers, God still hears us. We need to know, along with David's hearers, that the slander of those who love delusions and seek lies does not change the truth that God hears those he set apart. And then the psalm moves on again. So verse 1, David's cry to God. Verses 2 and 3, the slanderers. There's another kind of little section here, verses 4 and 5, which seems to be another group of people. I've called them the angry. Verse 4 and 5, that starts, tremble and do not sin. Or you might have, be angry and do not sin. Or in your anger, something like that. There's this idea of trembling with anger. These people are very angry. There might be a good reason for their anger. Maybe they're angry with Absalom. Maybe they're angry with Absalom's followers, who don't love God, who are doing the wrong thing in opposing David. And sometimes that's the case. I wonder what makes you angry. Maybe if you look at society around us, you see things that make you angry. Some of us went to a festival thing at the University of Bath recently, and it was a kind of family event, and in the middle on the parade, there was some pole dancing, which kind of makes you angry, doesn't it? Why did that happen? Who thought about that and allowed that to happen? That's not right, is it? There's probably plenty of things that you could read and hear about that the Christian Institute are talking about that might make you angry about the way people are talking and thinking in our society. Maybe they're angry for right reasons. We could be the same. There are lots of kind of heroes that are slightly angry in our society. I wonder if you have seen the Bourne films. Jason Bourne is a very kind of angry character, isn't he? What does he do? He feels wronged, he feels angry, and he goes and he knocks some heads together. He goes and does something about it. That kind of doesn't seem right, does it? And I think the danger here that David is saying is, well, even though you're trembling, even though you're angry, do not sin. That's the danger, that the anger might turn into something sinful. And David doesn't actually say, don't be angry or don't tremble with anger. He says, do not sin in your anger. And he counsels silence, which is interesting, instead of this kind of immediate action. I'm reminded of Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 19, which says this, sin is not ended by multiplying words, but the prudent hold their tongues. Okay, so sin is not ended by multiplying words, but the prudent hold their tongues. So in some situations, kind of saying too much is actually going to make things worse in terms of sin. Sometimes it's best to say nothing, and I think that's what's in view here. And look at what David goes on to say, when you're on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. So when you're on your beds, angry people, there's nothing special about a bed. He's just saying, well, sleep on it. Don't say anything. Think about it. Sleep on it. Think about it again in the morning. Your planned response is probably going to be very, very different, isn't it, after you've slept. I think it's just good practical advice here. And then he goes on, angry people, do not sin. When you're on your bed, search your hearts and be silent. Offer the sacrifices of the righteous. I think probably what's going on here is if you've been very angry, quite often that does involve sin, and probably there's going to be a need to ask for forgiveness, to repent, and to turn, in our case, to Jesus and trust in his sacrifice. I think it's very easy to overlook our own sin when we're angry, because we think, well, that's the thing that's made me angry. That's the person that's made me angry. That's where the sin is. That's what needs to be dealt with. And David said, no, you need to offer the sacrifices of the righteous. We need to make sure we don't overlook our own sin, because we're the ones who've been wronged or sinned against, or we're the ones who are angry at someone else's sin. We need to make sure, take care that we don't sin in our anger. And finally, he says to the angry people, trust in the Lord, trust in the Lord. Why does he say that? I think he's saying, look, angry people, you don't necessarily need to go and do a Jason Bourne and go on a rampage to try and sort out whatever's made you angry. That's not saying there's no cause for action. But I think he's reminding the angry people to trust in God, because he's in control. To remember that ultimately he is the one who'll deal with all the sin, all the unrighteousness, all the injustice of Absalom's rebellion, of anything else in history that we might face. I think we do well to remember that when we're angry. If we're angry with something in society around us, if we're angry with what other people are doing, if we're angry with our children, let's pray that we act and we speak in the framework of God's sovereignty and God's mercy, and that we don't act and speak in the framework of the heat of our own anger. Be angry and do not sin, he says to the angry people. Then the psalm moves on again and changes slightly. Verse 6, now David is talking to God again, but there's another kind of group of people, seemingly, who are in the frame. And these people, verses 6 to 7, I've called the despairing. Okay, so the cry, verse 1, the slanderers, the angry, and now the despairing. So these people, many, David says, Lord, are asking, who will bring us prosperity? Who will bring us prosperity? You might have, who will show us any good? Who will show us any good? Dale Ralph Davis, the commentator on the Psalms, says, translates this as they keep asking this. They keep saying it. Where is God? They're effectively asking. What is going on? Where is God? What's he doing? Why isn't he intervening in this way or that way? What's going on? They keep asking it. They're doubting perhaps God's goodness or God's love or God's power. And maybe that's because the country is being torn apart by this civil war. Maybe there's a lack of material blessing. Maybe they're just confused because David is God's anointed king and yet he seems to have been overthrown by Absalom. And what's going on? Where is God? What is he doing? And those are questions that we hear today. Those are questions we might ask ourselves today, aren't they? Where is God? What is he doing in our country? What is he doing in our world? And what's David's response to that question? Second half of verse 6, does he say, Lord, end this war and restore peace? Does he say, Lord, send us prosperity? Does he say, Lord, restore me to my throne and then everything will be all right? No, he doesn't say that. He says, let the light of your face shine on us. Is that interesting? Is that surprising? This is actually a quote from Numbers 6, where Aaron was commanded to bless the people. It's sometimes called the Aaronic blessing. That's not the ironic blessing, although it sounds like the ironic blessing, but it's the Aaronic blessing, which is Aaron, the high priest, and his sons, who were to say to the people, the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you and give you peace. You see, the high priest was to pronounce this blessing on the people of Israel. And I think that this blessing was kind of encapsulating God's relationship with his people Israel. That was what they were to expect from him. That was what they were to desire from him. And here you see, this is a loving God giving his best to his people. And that is how he chooses to summarize it in this blessing that Aaron was commanded and the high priests after him were commanded to speak to the people of Israel. You see, he could give them material blessings, and he did. He could give them family blessings, and he did. But what's the best he can give? This is how it's expressed. I think it's a bit like children and sweets. You know, if you've got children or if you see children around, they kind of say, oh, we really want sweets, we really want ice cream, we really want ice cream right now. And they'll say that all the time, every day, if you let them. And as a parent, you kind of, you know, sweets aren't that expensive. You know, probably most parents have the financial resources to give children sweets whenever they want. So why don't they? Well, it's not that parents don't love their children, so they don't give them sweets. And if they really love their children, then they give them sweets all the time. It's that we as parents want the best for our children, don't we? And actually, we think there is something better for our children than giving them sweets all the time. And they might not realize that, but that's what we want for them. And hopefully, what we in Emmanuel want for our children is more or less what David is saying here, isn't it? We want them to delight in the Lord, in seeing more of his grace, more of his glory. And I think it's really instructive that this is where David's thoughts turn in the moment of distress. How do you respond when you're in difficulty? What are your prayers like? Are your prayers, Lord, get me out of this difficulty? I mean, that's not wrong. David does say that, doesn't he, in verse 1. But is that all you pray? Or do you pray, Lord, show me what you're like. Show me more of your grace. Show me more of your glory. Let the light of your face shine on me. And this is, I think, a prayer that God would have us pray. I mean, not that we shouldn't pray that God would fix our situation. David does do that, and God does fix situations. But this is what we're told, I think, is best for us, whether or not God decides to give us relief from our present distress in the way that we think is best, in the timing that we think is best. This is always right, isn't it? And then David goes on in verse 7. Look at what he says. He says, "Fill my heart with joy when their grain and their new wine abound." In this translation, you don't see it, but it's kind of like David has more joy in God than when they, presumably these people who are saying who will show us prosperity, than when they have all the grain and the new wine, which is kind of the wealth, the way of saying being really wealthy and successful in that society. You see, David is saying he has greater joy in knowing God than when there's immense material blessing around. He's saying there's something better than abundant wealth and than prosperity. What makes you joyful? Is it wealth? Is it prosperity? Is it when things go really well at work? Is it having a family? Is it when your children are successful? When they're getting on well at school and you've got lots of friends? Is it marriage? Or is it knowing God's grace? Not that we shouldn't have joy in those other things, but what gives you most joy? I think that's probably a good measure of spiritual health, that question. Do you have joy in God? What if you don't? What do we do? How do we get it? Well, I think we can pray for it. I think David teaches us that much in the way that he's written this psalm, in the way that he is praying. We can read of God's character in the Bible, can't we? The more we expose ourselves to the truth about God's character, the more we can have joy in what he's like. We can remind each other, and Emmanuel, let's do that. Remind each other on Sundays whenever we see each other of how great God is, how loving God is, how merciful he is. And we can sing, can't we? And we do sing songs that remind us about God, that induce joy, hopefully, in our hearts. Okay, and then the last verse, which kind of follows on from this response to the people who are despairing. Verse 8, "The peace that comes. In peace," David says, "I will lie down and sleep. For you, O Lord, make me dwell in safety." So despite the turmoil of his situation, remember, his own son is trying to kill him. A lot of his subjects are rising up against him. He's had to run away from his palace in Jerusalem, the capital city. He's probably sleeping in a tent or somewhere he's not used to. Despite this situation and this threat that he's facing and the various reactions of these other people that we've seen, these angry people, these despairing people, these people who are opposed to him, who are loving lies and delusions. Despite all of this, David is able to sleep in peace because he trusts in God. He lies down and sleeps. Okay, he doesn't lie down and then and lie awake for a long time, thinking about what's going on, and then eventually he falls asleep. That's not the way the verse reads. He lies down and sleeps. "I will lie down and sleep," one after the other. I think it's a simple kind of childlike trust in God. Chris spoke last week about sleeping like a baby, didn't he? So babies, they don't worry about things. They just sleep, don't they? When they're tired, they just go to sleep, eventually. But they're not worrying about where the next meal is going to come from or what their career is going to be like or who they're going to marry or, you know, they're not worrying about that, are they? They're just sleeping. And David is almost sleeping like that because he knows he doesn't need to worry about it. He knows that God is in control. And he says, "You alone, O Lord, can make me dwell in safety." God is the only one who can give that kind of peace. You see, the false gods and the people who love the delusions, who are seeking the lies, they're not going to get that peace from what they're seeking. God alone can give that. And the implications of verse 7 and 8 are huge, if you think about it. Because what's astonishing is that even in the midst of fleeing from Jerusalem, even in the midst of facing this rebellion, David can say he has great joy in his God, and he experiences this amazing peace. So maybe you have uncertainty about where you're going to live. Maybe you have concerns about your children. Maybe you have pressures in the workplace. Maybe you have exams. Maybe you're worried about the future. There are lots of things that could make us distressed, that could make us worried. But verse 7 and 8 shows us that this peace and this joy are available to those in extreme suffering, extreme distress. And if this is available to David, then it's available to us, isn't it? David was a weak and a sinful follower of Jesus. We read he committed adultery, he murdered the husband of the woman that he committed adultery with, and he sinned and he fell, and you know, he wasn't anyone special in that sense. He was a servant of God, wasn't he? If this peace and this joy is available to him, it's available to us. And that's amazing, isn't it? We have a God who can give the greatest joy, even in the moment of distress. That's amazing, isn't it? The Lord said to Moses, "Tell Aaron and his sons, this is how you are to bless the Israelites. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face towards you and give you peace. So they will put my name on the Israelites and I will bless them."